From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In the fall of 2008, with the financial system on the verge of collapse, 17 large banks that were being propped up by taxpayers doled out $1.6 billion in bonuses. Today, the Obama administration's pay czar, Kenneth Feinberg, passed judgment. He said the payouts were ill-advised, but he also said he did not believe the payments were contrary to public interest, nor does he plan to ask the companies to pay the money back. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The 17 companies making the big bonus payments while on government life support include Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America. Feinberg described the payments in an interview with NPR following a briefing on his report at the Treasury.
Some of these payments, many of them, were over $10 million per individual, which were, in our view, ill-advised.
Not only ill-advised, but undeserved. In many cases, Feinberg says, the bonuses were given based on no criteria.
Or criteria such as, well, we guaranteed it regardless of performance. This official's leaving the company, and we want to give him or her a very lucrative severance package.
Now, remember, these are big banks that had taken billions of dollars in government support and were paying out bonuses in the depths of the financial crisis. So why isn't Feinberg demanding a refund for taxpayers?
First, Congress didn't give me the power to do anything more than ask. I have no enforcement authority. Secondly, 11 of these 17 companies had already, at the time of my inquiry, had already reimbursed the taxpayer.
And, says Feinberg, the companies had done nothing illegal. That's because these bonuses were handed out during the window between congressional approval of the $700 billion TARP fund late in 2008 and the restrictions on compensation Congress passed early in 2009. Feinberg also decided against asking for a refund from the six firms that have not paid back the TARP. In the case of Citigroup, Feinberg defends that decision by pointing out that the giant bank has paid back some of its TARP loans. In addition, it's largely overhauled its pay practices to meet government guidelines.
So I thought that they had already complied with our requests.
Nicole Tishon, an expert on compensation issues with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, says these bonuses for bankers are clearly contrary to the public interest. She says it's a shame Feinberg wasn't able to act more forcefully.
His hands are somewhat tied in terms of statutorily what he could do, but I don't think it's going to sit well with your average families and average taxpayers that while these individuals were bringing down the economy, they were paying themselves these lavish bonuses.
This report is Feinberg's last as the so-called pay czar. He says he doesn't know whether he's had a lasting impact. Feinberg says he's more confident that the broad range of initiatives on pay from the Federal Reserve, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the financial overhaul legislation could make a difference.
I'd like to think that if you look at the entire menu, we've had an appreciable impact on pay going forward.
Feinberg now takes on his next endeavor, presiding over payouts from the $20 billion BP fund to compensate victims of the massive Gulf oil spill. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
Three top city administrators in the small Los Angeles suburb of Bell last night resigned. That's after their hefty salaries sparked outrage among the city's poor and working-class residents. Bell's chief administrative officer hauled in nearly $800,000 a year, likely the highest salary for any city manager in the country and almost twice the pay of President Obama. From member station KPCC, Frank Stoltz reports.
Angry residents waited until the Bell City Council finished a marathon closed-door meeting at midnight to hear the news.
Number one, the chief administrative officer, Mr. Robert Rizzo, has resigned effective August 30th, 2010.
In addition to Rizzo, the police chief, who made nearly $500,000 a year, and the assistant city manager, who made almost $400,000, stepped down. The resignations failed to quell residents' rage. Many want to see the recall of city council members who approved the big salaries and have voted to pay themselves $100,000 a year for their part-time work in one of the poorest cities in the region. Ali Saleh is with the Bell Association to stop the abuse.
There's no faith in them anymore for them to stay any longer.
Bell sits about 10 miles southeast of downtown Los Angeles. Its 40,000 residents are 90% Latino. More than half are foreign-born. Like most municipalities, Bell has laid off workers as it struggles with declining tax revenues. Still, Mayor Oscar Hernandez defended city salaries to local television station KTLA.
If you want a good service, I think you deserve to get a good money, don't you?
How do you justify $800,000 in a city this small and this poor?
The only thing I say, this community, they receiving a good service.
That hasn't convinced State Attorney General Jerry Brown, who's opened an investigation into Bell's pay practices. Councilman Lorenzo Velez receives a fraction of his colleague's salary. He said he only became aware of the big salaries recently and that the scandal sends a message.
It is important for everybody, everywhere and wherever you are, to stay aware of what's going on in your municipality and in your city hall.
One remaining question, whether the top officials who've resigned will receive pensions as high as $650,000 a year for the rest of their lives. The California Public Employees Retirement System says it's looking into the matter. For NPR News, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. As a way of tracking the housing crisis, our Planet Money team bought a toxic asset. It's filled with home loans from across the country, some from people who borrowed more than they could afford. But it turns out this Planet Money asset contains something else. At least one mortgage that could be part of a $200 million mortgage fraud scheme. NPR's Hannah Jaffe Walt takes a look at one Sarasota house in that scheme, a house that was bought and sold six times in 4 years and more than tripled in value.
The first person to own the home was probably the last man who truly loved that house on Cove Terrace Road.
Fred Bloom is my name.
Fred Bloom?
Fred Bloom. Isn't that a great name for an allergist?
Dr. Fred Bloom, the allergist, met me outside the Cove Terrace house. It's nice. Four bedrooms, red tile roof. It's painted that sort of Florida peachy color. It's got a pool and a boat dock.
It had a two-story family room with windows up above, and you could sit there and watch lightning, and you could watch the sky.
Dr. Bloom's kids grew up. He and his wife separated, and he reluctantly put the house up for sale.
And it didn't sell, and it didn't sell, and it didn't sell. And I wasn't happy about that. I was not happy about lowering the price.
And then we had an offer from Craig Adams.
This is Candy Swick, Dr. Bloom's real estate agent. Now, getting an offer from Craig Adams was nothing to sneeze at. Adams was well known in Sarasota as a guy who could make any deal happen. Some even used the word genius.
Craig's offer was very good. It was right on the mark, and it was like, this is good. Take it and run. It's been enough time.
And I resisted as long as I could and then decided the fight is over. So I caved in.
Dr. Bloom sold the house for $600,000, much less than he wanted for it. And then, 2 weeks later, he's at the grocery store and he runs into his former Cove Terrace neighbors. Hey, how you doing? How are the new people on the block?
And they told me that my house had sold again. And he mentioned the price of $725. And I was really upset. And I said, that's $125,000 more than I got for it. And that was only a matter of a couple of weeks.
Oh, it was weeks?
It was just a matter of a couple of weeks. Yeah, I was not happy.
That is an understatement. Dr. Bloom was furious at his real estate agent and held on to that resentment for 10 years. 10 years until what really happened at Cove Terrace came out.
My name is Matthew Doig. I'm an investigative reporter at the Sarasota Herald Tribune.
Doig and his colleagues have been piecing together what they say could be a $200 million mortgage scheme led by Craig Adams.
Adams put together the deal and apparently took it to his associate, a guy named Steve Wexler, and just basically said, here's this deal, sign on the dotted line. Don't worry about it. You're not even going to own this property that long. In 2 weeks, we're going to sell it to our buddy Keyworth for $725,000.
Doig explains, here's how this would work. Adams had a group of friends and associates, and one would buy a house, sell to another and another for higher and higher prices. The sales wouldn't get listed publicly, and Adams would set the prices. With each sale, someone would take out a loan that would pay off the previous loan. And since it was bigger than the last one, there'd be extra cash to split among the players.
After Dr. Bloom is out of the picture, that house is completely controlled by Craig Adams. And every time it is sold, Adams is representing both the buyer and the seller.
In 4 years, the Cove Terrace house had six owners and went from $600,000 to more than $2 million. Dr. Bloom became more and more confused. The house didn't look any better. In fact, it looked worse.
Occasionally, I would drive by the house, and at various times, the yard was really in disrepair.
When it was in disrepair, did it look like no one was living here?
Yes, it looked like it was vacant.
Guy Sakala is publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance, and he says he's seen this sort of thing all over the country. As long as there's a housing bubble, it works pretty well.
The idea is if you can keep selling a house for more than you're borrowing, you'll always make out ahead. You know what?
Eventually, it's a loan. You eventually have to pay the bank back.
Correct. There wasn't a great exit strategy. You know, in hindsight, these weren't geniuses figuring out these plans.
By 2007, the Cove Terrace house was owned by yet another associate of Craig Adams, a guy who defaulted on more than $2 million in loans. The bank foreclosed on the house. Now, the banks or lenders clearly lose big time in this scenario. They kept handing out loans because they too were caught up in the bubble. With home values rising so quickly, who's to say that six owners in 4 years is really all that strange?
It's a fine line between what's a legitimate real estate investment and committing actual fraud.
Sakala says, look, we have a reality TV show about flipping houses. At the height of the bubble, a third of the people buying properties were never planning to live in those homes. That doesn't mean all those loans were fraudulent, but mortgage fraud doesn't have to be all that dramatic. It can be just fudging your income a little. The FBI is looking into more than 3,000 cases of mortgage fraud right now. And in Sarasota, they're doing it with the help of Craig Adams. The Herald Tribune has reported that he's gone from real estate genius to FBI informant. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
California could become the first state to legalize marijuana use if voters approve an initiative on the fall ballot. But some California cities are already starting to rev up the marijuana industry. This month, the Oakland City Council moved forward on a landmark ordinance to license four giant medical marijuana cultivation centers. The plan could bring millions of dollars in tax revenue to the city's cash-starved government. But it's not known how much of this is legal and who decides. From member station KQED, Michael Montgomery has the story.
Jeff Wilcox doesn't look anything like a pot kingpin. He's polite, laughs at himself, and dresses in crisp business casuals. But if he has his way, Wilcox could become owner of one of the world's largest licensed marijuana farms.
The complex is about two-thirds empty.
Walking across a deserted parking lot, Wilcox surveys a cluster of empty offices, then enters a cavernous warehouse the size of a football field.
It is about 43,000 square feet. This warehouse has been vacant for 10 years looking for a tenant.
The warehouse is part of a sleepy 7-acre business park that Wilcox bought 12 years ago. It's squeezed between a major freeway and the Oakland Harbor. Wilcox wants to devote the facility to pot cultivation, provided he can convince the city to award him one of four medical marijuana growing permits.
We looked at it like a land developer would look at a project. What's the benefits to the city for jobs and revenue? We figured if 100,000 foot at the maximum was under cultivation, at today's rate, the revenue would be about $60 million.
You've talked about having the capacity to grow 21,000 pounds of marijuana, cannabis a year. That's a lot more than consumed in the entire city of Oakland.
Exactly, and that was always the objective by the city of Oakland.
Meaning that medical marijuana grown here could be sold to dispensaries around the state, with Oakland getting a healthy cut from a sales tax. The sheer scale of the plan has raised a lot of eyebrows, even among marijuana advocates like Dale Geringer. He directs the California chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
The pot farm that's envisioned here is of unprecedented size, at least for any legal facility in the United States or North America, probably.
The question is this legal? California's vague medical marijuana laws allow collectives or cooperatives to cultivate medical marijuana for members. But Geringer says the laws don't address commercial growers and wholesalers.
Here we're introducing a whole new layer of intermediate suppliers who basically sell it to other collectives and dispensaries. It's not strictly kosher under state law, and I'm sure there it could be subject to litigation.
Or perhaps raids by federal drug agents.
They would be a significant target.
Tommy Lanier directs the National Marijuana Initiative, which is funded by the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy.
If you're going to facilitate transportation, production, distribution on such a large scale, the federal government would be involved in that.
Both the DEA and the Department of Justice declined to say whether they'll take action against Oakland over the pot farms. Oakland City Council member Rebecca Kaplan, who co-authored the plan, says she believes the Obama administration will respect local laws.
We're certainly taking them at their word, knowing that we're working to create responsible regulations.
But council member Nancy Nadell says the city should revise the ordinance to a more modest scale.
You don't want a banana republic. You don't want your city's, all of your industrial property to all be tied up in this one crop. You want to have a diversity of businesses in your city.
Back at his Oakland warehouse, Jeff Wilcox says he agrees. That's why he says he's registered his business as a nonprofit and is offering space to smaller growers and other entrepreneurs. Wilcox says the key is bringing marijuana cultivation out of the shadows and into the realm of a professional business.
There's the new guard coming in, people like me, that can get things done legislative-wise and business-wise. So, in essence, you could say big business is here, or you could say the end of prohibition, possibly, and the future of a new industry.
With a lot of luck, Wilcox says he could have his first crop of industrial-grown medical marijuana ready for harvesting sometime next year. For NPR News, I'm Michael Montgomery.